Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana, and the wilderness areas of New Canaan, Connecticut. This is Larry Batson. This is Blog Talk Radio, and this is My Wild World. Hope everybody's getting ready for the Christmas holiday. We have got a fantastic show for you tonight, so find a comfortable seat and a cold beverage and sit around for the next hour because we definitely have a legend with us this evening. Jim Fowler is one of the best-known naturalists and has presented information about wildlife and wilderness to the American public on television. For more than 40 years, he first served with Marlon Perkins, we all remember Marlon, as co-host and later became host of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. He also hosted Mutual of Omaha's Spirit of Adventure, and these programs received awards including 4 Emmys and endorsement by the National PTA for Family Viewing. In addition to ongoing appearances as many network talk shows, Fowler was the wildlife correspondent for the NBC Today show since 1988, and as we all know, he was the regular on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. He was featured on Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom on Animal Planet in the Magnificent Moments. We could talk for hours. He's also president of the Fowler Center for Wildlife Education in New York, and he serves as honorary president of the Explorers Club, and in 1994, he received the prestigious Explorers Club Medal, the club's highest honor. Fowler is also on the board of Friends of Conservation, Diane Fossey's Gorilla Fund, and the Global Communications for Conservation. Folks, it's a great pleasure. My good buddy, Mr. Jim Fowler. Nice to have you on, Jim.
Oh, thank you. Who wrote that introduction? That sounds a little bit familiar, but...
Well, I read it right off this dark press release.
Okay.
Because they packed it all in there pretty good, you know. I thought about this for the last couple of days, how I was going to introduce you. Because, you know, you're one of the people that really doesn't need much of an introduction. Because anybody, I mean, the years and years on the Johnny Carson show. And, of course, Sunday nights, I believe it was about 7:30 p.m., Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, Jim Fowler, Marlon Perkins.
Yeah.
That was, I'm going to tell you, that was way before the crocodile hunter was even a gleam in somebody's eye.
That's right. Well, you know, it's pretty amazing. I don't think that Mutual of Omaha still understand how many families were watching Wild Kingdom in those early days. I run across so many people that say that same thing.
Well, I have to go ahead.
It was a family-oriented show, in the right sense of the word, and the whole family could sit around and watch it. Nowadays, it seems to be pretty fragmented. There are not many programs that the entire family can watch.
Well, I have to say that I've never told you this before, because Jim and I have had the opportunity to work together on several different events, and all the old Johnny Carson show, Merv Griffin, Regis Philbin, in Los Angeles.
Yep.
But, you know, the first time that you called me, that's when we were based in Indianapolis, and it was in August, if I remember. It was just hot. And we were in the monkey building cleaning monkeys, and I get this phone call, and you introduced yourself, and I thought to myself right then, which one of my friends is trying to pull something on me? I could not believe.
Okay.
Jim Fowler was calling me up, and you were up in South Bend for the Shriners, and you said, if you could bring some animals up, I'd really appreciate it. And I'll tell you what, that was a special evening. I have to tell you that right now.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you have that memory. I was really trying to think back how I first heard about you. Well, a lot of people around the Indianapolis area knew about you. But one of my dilemmas is that people call me and say, would I come speak? Quite a lot, I mean, for many years. And then they say, parenthetically, by the way, bring your animals. I don't think they want me at all. They want my animals. So when I go somewhere sometimes, actually, I'm not complaining, because when you have something alive, as you well know, in front of an audience, the audience really feels connected. And that's one of course, the missions is to help reconnect families and children back with the world of nature. But it's sort of the icing on the cake when you have something alive there. I'm continually surprised, and I'm sure you are too, about how often it is a lot of the people in the audience have never seen some of the animals that we bring around and really, unfortunately, can't even hardly identify them.
Well, you know, the kids are used to a computer screen or a television flat screen. And nothing replaces having the animal right there.
No, it really doesn't. And you know, we've got to overcome some obstacles these days, because unfortunately, quite a few of the members of the media seem to want to paint a picture that animals are dangerous and are going to hurt us all the time. You know, if there's somebody scratched or bitten by an animal, it's on the air for weeks and weeks. And I think, Larry, I know one of the reasons why that is. I've been very interested. You know, when Siegfried and Roy got tangled up and one of their cats bit Roy, you know, it was on for a long time.
Right.
And there's been a recent incident in Stamford, Connecticut, where a chimp got, you know, well, first of all, that was a very mixed up chimp. That was a delusional chimp and a handicapped woman. They were both working together. And of course, that sort of thing should never have been allowed to happen. But the media had a ball with that. They still are. So I think here's, if I'm not mistaken, here's one of the things that's happened. You know, we are in our genetic material. We've been downloaded, you might say, or programmed to be horrified by the idea of being bitten or clawed. It's in our genetic material, because there was one time when, you know, we were in the cave and the saber-toothed tiger and a few others were having us for lunch. So that's been ingrained in us over the years, but we haven't been around on this planet long enough to be horrified by the idea of being killed or mangled or maimed by a machine. You know, we just aren't. If you were, you would never ride on or drive on I-95. My goodness, you know, the horrification that happens when there's a bad accident often far exceeds that of a animal bite, but it's not in our genetic material. So I don't think the media understands all this, but they sure do know that they get a lot of mileage out of something when somebody's bitten. So one of the first things I have to do when I lecture with an animal, I try to point out that fear is usually a lack of knowledge, and that if you know how to handle something, it's really not all that dangerous. You know, I don't think I ever told you, I'm starting a club, because last year in America there were 84,000 people were maimed by lawnmowers. If you want to know what's really dangerous to humans, it has nothing to do with animals, but anyway, there were 2,000 children were actually killed by these rideable lawnmowers backing over some kid, some neighbor kid or their own. It's horrible. So I'm starting a group, and if the lawnmowers get out of your yard, we're going to shoot them. It's going to be shoot the lawnmower group, yeah. And by God, if that doesn't get some publicity, I don't know what will. But it's true. Animals have nothing to do, really, with statistically, or you couldn't even put it on a graph, that animals are dangerous to people.
Well, that's true. And the experienced animal handlers, it's a whole different ballgame. Like the chimp incident, I think the chimp was on Thorazine, for one thing. And I think someone told me it had Lyme disease. And it was medicated. And as you know, Jim, an adult chimp is a pretty tough customer. And it takes a skilled animal handler. Yeah, because they live basically in a world of violence.
Well, they also are competing with each other all the time and have to protect themselves. But you see, we always, the chimps look so human. We like to apply human terms to them and call them mean or aggressive or cruel, all these terms. That doesn't even exist in the language of animals. Those are human descriptions, and that chimp was handicapped intellectually and mentally. That chimp was mentally retarded, and so was the woman.
Yes.
And that's sort of a dangerous situation to get into. A chimp, oh, I know how strong chimps are. Once on Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, we had a sort of a mascot, and we had one, a fairly smaller one called WK, but the big old chimp was called Mr. Moak. They were from the St. Louis Zoo. And Mr. Moak had quite a history. He had his keeper had fallen in love with him and actually kidnapped Moak from the zoo and taken him down to Florida. I don't know whether they were going on vacation together or what. Something like that. But anyway, they finally got Moak back, and he was the first chimp that could write his name on a blackboard and say Mama.
Really?
Which was quite an accomplishment, yeah. So he ended up on Wild Kingdom. We would have him there in the beginning of the show, and I'll never forget. I told Marlon one morning, we had had Moak on the night before, and I said, Marlon, Moak's got something in for me. You know how you can tell that when you first look at a animal. I could see that Moak was disturbed by me, and it was probably because he didn't get enough to eat the day before, because we were, there were some bad takes, and we had to start all over again. And I guess he associated that with me. So I was supposed to come out of a double door and reach down to this lovable chimp who weighed about 150 pounds and sort of pick him up. Well, I no more had opened the door, but I saw Moak's eyes sort of spitting fire, and he came over and slugged me right between the eyes.
Ooh.
Tell you what, I saw stars. I'd never been hit by. Now, I would have hit him first, but it was on camera, and I would have been a bad guy.
Right.
So I had to take it, and boy, my legs were wobbly. But I'll never forget it. You know why? It was that same day that the two boxers, Liston, knocked out Patterson. They were the famous boxers of the day, and I remember that because Moak almost knocked me out. But yeah, chimps and animals. But, it is so rare. I mean, look at you. Look at the animals that you've raised over the years. There have been a few times that there have been some contact, and you've had to know what you're doing. But generally, that doesn't even pose a problem.
No.
Every time somebody's scared or hurt by a grizzly bear out west, it's all over the news. If you went to Florida, you would think, with all the publicity, that a shark would come out of the water into your motel room and have you for lunch, for crying out loud. I haven't had that happen yet, but there are only about 12 incidents of sharks killing people around the world every year. So
really?
We've got to get back on track. What you do, and what most lecturers should do, is to first of all try to dispel that myth, because why are we going to save something if it's out there trying to kill us, see? So, it's very difficult. Tigers are down to a couple thousand in India. And, there are occasionally people knocked off by tigers who wander, tending to their crops or something. But it's still a very small portion of what really happens to people.
Well, exactly. It's, like you say, it someone hurt by a lawnmower doesn't make a good news story. Not interested.
That's right. You got it. Yeah.
Or
well,
exactly.
There are poor people killed by subways in New York almost every month, and taxi cabs are getting out of control all the time and knocking people off. But you won't read about it on the first page like you will an animal.
No, not at all.
We've got another problem, and you know
that?
What that is. Well, the regulatory system in America has gone from sometimes education. But nowadays, it's all law enforcement-oriented, and our great friends at the U.S. Department of Agriculture have actually switched from being an organization that administers the Animal Welfare Act, which is taking care of animals, how people relate to animals. Now it's protecting people from animals. They've switched it around as if that's a big problem. And it's probably because a lot of the regulatory agencies are interested in job security. So the more they prohibit, the less somebody comes back on them and says, how come you did that? But it really comes down to the base root where the media play up the bites and the claws and that sort of thing. And any regulatory agency, they're the first people they're going to come after if, you know, it's exaggerated out of proportion. So we've got to do something because the work you do with animals and the work I've done all these years and many, many other people is one of the last hopes for reconnecting families and children with the world of nature.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I have lost track of the schools that I've been to where I've had teachers come up to me after the program or principals telling us that these kids, you know, especially in these rural communities, they would not have the opportunity to even see such animals.
No, they wouldn't.
And as you know, most zoos are really strictly entertainment. I mean, you don't really, not unless you stop and read every sign, learn anything.
Well, you know, you're going to get me going here on my soapbox if you don't watch out.
Oh, that's okay. We have an hour.
Well, there's some good, obviously, a lot of good urban zoological parks who provide a service.
Absolutely.
But it's generally true that often a private individual has the incentive to really get into it and become more of an effective spokesperson for the natural world, which, by the way, should be the goal of anybody that's working with animals in front of the public. Zoological parks sometimes restrict their educational staff so much, but it's pretty darn hard for them to understand. The only reason to show animals to people is very interesting. How often this is rarely done in the zoological world. You know, you'll have people come in or school come in, and they'll put them in a classroom like the one that they came from, and they'll show them a field mouse and a black snake, and they'll tell you all the information about those two animals that you can possibly remember, you know, how they live, how many young they had, and all that sort of thing. But you know what's missing? They don't say one word about what's in it for humans. We've
Absolutely.
Got to start linking all this, what I call information. See, the facts and the figures, and often they call it education, but it isn't. That's what I call information. Now, there's a big difference between information and education, and you can quote me on this if you'd like, although I'm sure you have your own way of expressing it. But information, in my opinion, is sort of when you sit on a hot stove the first time. It goes right up through your backside. But guess what education is? That's when you won't sit on the stove the second time. It has to affect your life.
That's
and
right.
Anybody who's sat on a hot stove is pretty well educated, too. But
that's a pretty good analogy.
That's a pretty good analogy, don't you think? Yeah, I worked hard on that one because it appalls me sometimes to see what people call education. It really isn't education. A lot of the stuff you learn, unfortunately, when you go through quite a few of the zoological parks, it's wonderful information. But see, here's the point. In universities, and you can see I've thought a little bit about this, mm-hmm. but in the university world and scholastic world, you have to develop a lot of information in order to get a job, be a manager, to do research. So you're taught an awful lot of information, but very seldom should that be called education, because education is when all that information actually affects human welfare and affects your life. So I'm trying to get, you know, in my talks, I'm trying to talk a whole lot more about what's in it for somebody working for a living trying to feed their family. Why should they be interested in open space, wildlife, and wilderness? And I noticed that very few even of the conservation organizations even talk about that. They also depart and talk about a lot of information and put out fires, but very few of them, and you won't see people on Sunday morning television talking about this either. You won't see too many people that are out there relating those two things together with the human world and why we humans need these connections and what's in it for us. How's
well,
that for a soapbox?
Oh, that's great. Well, what I've always said, I realize them. The other day we did a program for 800 elementary school kids in Warsaw, Indiana.
Okay.
And I realized that we're not speaking to 800 future zoologists or biologists, but they're going to be 800 young people that are going to grow up and they're going to vote and they're going to make decisions and they're going to hopefully understand why we need places like our national park system, our wilderness areas, and we need to designate places for wild animals.
There you go.
And like you've always said, and I've stolen this from you many times, you know, the quality of life is not nearly as great when these animals are gone as when they're here. And
There's several things, and I would like to take a moment and talk about some of the real arguments why open space and wildlife and wilderness is important to humans. If we can't answer that question, we never are going to save the natural world. So I've tried to define all that, and it's rather interesting that in our compulsive, headlong quest for economic prosperity, which is obviously a basic instinct in humans, it's a basic biological instinct to better your life, to develop comfort, and it's material possessions. There are quite a few animals that collect material things and stick them around. You know, the pack rats will always collect things and seem like they own them, but humans are very good at that. So biologically, we do pursue all these things and try to sometimes make it have better health and better lives, but we humans are very possessive, and we've got to start learning that one of the greatest incentives for keeping the natural world intact, it's revenue producing from ecotourism. One of the facts of life, whether we like it or not, is some of those animals in Africa and some endangered species, if it weren't for the fact that tourism is bringing income into the countries as a result of some of these wildlife and areas and wilderness areas, there might have been much less wildlife already. I mean, obviously it's disappearing in so many different areas. So we've got to consider the economic advantages to ecotourism and or adventure tourism, whatever we want to call it. The second thing, that argument that I... Oh, by the way, tourism in America is the number two industry. I think maybe agriculture may be one. But a lot of that tourism is not just going down and lying on the beach. We have a tremendous number of states that benefit and have trickle-down economics, you know, into the motels, the hotels, the restaurants, from people that come in from out of state. And, of course, that's one of the best money-earning devices you can get because it's newfound money. The second argument that I use is that what's called quality of life, which actually we don't discuss what quality of life is very often. Obviously, quality of life is different to different people in different societies, different tribes, etc., etc. But we need to start opening up discussions. Is quality of life, going to the supermarket or the shopping mall and watching television, hanging out at the bar, and playing golf, or does it have something with getting out in the world of nature and taking your family up a creek and having a picnic or whatever? There are people that don't have too many material possessions that need that experience in the natural world in order to have a quality of life, and that's something we need to dwell on. In Eastern Europe, which is so industrialized, you can't go down a creek or up a river and have a quiet picnic with your family or be with your family. You can hardly go fishing anymore. So all these outdoor activities are very important to quality of life. Now, the third argument is even more powerful. Now, whether we can, I'm looking for arguments that might affect somebody who's a voter who's working for a living trying to feed their family. The third argument is that almost all of the great social tragedies that are happening in the world today, from Haiti to Somalia to Rwanda to Afghanistan to Iraq, they're all caused because we and the civilizations that went before us destroyed the natural resources in those areas. For example, in Haiti, there's not hardly a tree left. I don't know if you've been down there yet, but they've used all that for firewood. So you have people who are warlords, essentially, or dictators, and you have and have-nots. And, of course, when the have-nots get restless, that's when a lot of this happens. Rwanda is, I think it's got the highest rate of birth rate in any country in Africa, and over 6% have AIDS, but you can't really find a flat area on which to put a field for your crops. Right now, they're terracing Rwanda even more than Nepal. They're having to plant things on the slopes and make terraces because they're so crowded. And, of course, the gorilla, which lives in northern Rwanda, is having problems because people are trying to take over all the habitat in that country. Now, Afghanistan, a goat could hardly make a living in Afghanistan. There's hardly any vegetation left. Well, look what's happened there. Once again, the warlords are sort of the rule of the country, and people are looking for a way to feed themselves, and they look at the United States. This happened in Iraq, too. The Middle East looks at the television and see everything that the U.S. has, they think. You don't know how hard we have to work for it, but they become a bit jealous and envy. Well, first thing that happens, envy very quickly turns into hatred, and that's happened in the radical religious sense. So there's no wonder that the U.S. is sort of actually hated in some of these areas. Now, Iraq used to be the cradle of civilization. There were seven civilizations that disappeared in that country, and it's been hammered, not unlike a feedlot on some farmer's land, you know, where it's been trampled, and all that area has, it used to be green. So anyway, you gotta realize that the great social tragedies always happen when you exceed the capacity of the land to support the species, and you really have to fight for resources. Right now, oil is the only resource they've got. And some people say water is the next thing that's going to be fought over. I think it's rather interesting why the natural world is really important to us, and we have to balance on this planet. We've got to be careful going over putting concrete on more than 50% of this this planet Earth of ours.
Well, that's true. Well, let's think of, you know, when you were talking about the water aspect, if they would have told us 30 years ago that we'd spend $1.50 for a bottle of water to drink.
That's true. Yeah.
We would have thought, it's more than gasoline.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, and it's probably just as polluted as it ever was. Some people are taking it. Hey, I know your state of Indiana, where sometimes the old gasoline station's leaked, and in that limestone you find sheets of gasoline spreading out underneath in the groundwater. That's pretty frightening, isn't it?
Yeah, well, absolutely.
I love Indiana, don't get me wrong. But,
well, a lot of people don't realize this, but you lived in Indiana. You went there on college.
There you go. Sure did.
And we've gone back to Earlham College a couple times and done some things. And
yeah, they Earlham College had a great department of natural history. And it's a liberal arts college, so you could learn a lot of other things. But Larry, I caught a disease there. I think my son Mark has the same disease. The disease is that nobody told me what I couldn't do. You've got the same disease, I think.
Yes,
but,
I do.
That's one of the things about America. You know, I've had lots of people from overseas tell me that, you know, in some of their countries, like Lebanon and others, you can dream. But the U.S. is one of the few places that you have a chance of the dream coming true.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, we're going to take a break. We've got some PSAs. So, we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Get you a cold beverage, Jim. Man, this is outstanding. Folks,
so
we'll be
got
back
another, in a, we, well, I haven't been telling stories. I haven't been telling stories yet.
Well,
so
we'll
try that.
We'll
right.
tell the stories. We'll go to a break here.
Okay.
And get you
all
a cold
right.
beverage. And this there is Blog go. Talk Radio. This is Larry Batson's Wild World. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE to schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of RAD. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend.
While many talk about these ideals without action, they are just empty words.
If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education.
thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
We're Rascal Flatts. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. This is Larry Batson's Wild World, and man, what a night we have tonight. We have a legend, without a doubt. One of my favorite people, and I would have to say a good friend for over 20 years. Mr. Jim Fowler of the television show Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. Of course, it's many, many appearances on the Tonight Show, and we're going to talk about some of the escapades that happened with Johnny and Ed McMahon over those years. That was a lot of fun, wasn't it, Jim?
Yeah, it was. It was great fun until that night you brought the Celebes ape, Doc, and brought him out to me. That was quite a night. In fact, that's being rerun on a lot of Johnny's tapes. But, you know, before I get around to Doc, of course, Johnny was so great because Johnny was knew what television was all about. He never tried to be funny like some of the other ones do. But Johnny would let either Don Rickles or my animals do something, then he would relate to it. He had a keen sense of the absurd, and he was very quick. But, of course, Jay Leno's a great guy, but he's sort of like the kind of guy that would stick a little baby fox in the face of the band leader and say, aha. But that's not happening unpredictably. See, that's somebody trying to make something happen or trying to be funny. Anyway, several times I was on Johnny, and I knew that Marlon Perkins or the chairman of Mutual of Omaha were watching. And, oh boy, I tell you, certain things happened because Johnny would come out and pretend to be Marlon Perkins, if you remember that.
Right.
And he would raise his voice and he'd say, now, Jim, you go downriver and wrestle the two-horned rhino in heat while I stay back and mix martinis for the native girls. Marlon was a consummate zoo director. He was a great guy, but he didn't think that was very funny. So the chairman of the board of Mutual of Omaha that night told Marlon, he said, look, Marlon, when Johnny Carson kids you, it's the highest form of flattery. But Johnny would really grind that in. He had some great ones. And Johnny used to tell me, you see, now I hope Marlon Perkins is not annoyed at, you know, my takeoffs on him. But Johnny would actually raise his voice and then talk very much like Marlon. Marlon was a great guy. He passed away when he about 1986 from lymphoma. But, you know, I've never heard, I went all over the world with Marlon, I never heard him complain once about what he's doing. He just loved every minute of it, and he was very much a scientist. He was quest for knowledge, and but sometimes he got in a little trouble. Now, the reason they would send Marlon off one place and me the other one was the producer of Wild Kingdom could actually make more money that way because it's easier to edit the show. They didn't see what was coming. I mean, I'm sure the last thing he thought would happen would be the legend of Wild Kingdom would be, you know, Marlon Perkins send me out to do the dirty work. Johnny used to say that the reason Marlon did that is that I was the only guy he could find who was dumb enough to do what I said to do. But then now we're coming down to Doc because, you know, my problem was I had to have animals that would do something. I started out that way. You know, Joan Embry could come on from the San Diego Zoo, and she had animals that are accustomed to being held in your arms and walked around with. Then she could bring up on something with Johnny, and he would hold it, and it would make faces, and Johnny would make faces. And she always had a source of animals. But my case, they used to ask me to be on a lot, but I wasn't going to be on unless I had something that was really good and something that was possible for doing something with it. You know, I used to, I actually ran cheetahs to a lure once up on the stage there, and I had two big tigers that weighed about 250 pounds apiece. I knew they liked to take baths in a bathtub. So we rigged the tub so that I had to put some water in it because with a big hose, because I knew that these tigers had learned to wrestle a hose whenever they saw a hose. So I gave Johnny the hose, and tigers were soaking wet in the tub, bathtub, and he went over with the hose, put some more water in, and sort of grabbed the hose, and there was a nice tug of war, which got people's attention. Then the tigers shook themselves all over the band, but the band had already taken off by that time. So anyway, those are some of the things that went on. But the worst, one of the reruns, of course, that's out there all the time now, that good old Larry Batson had a Celebes ape that was probably one of the ugliest looking creatures you've ever seen in your life from a anthropomorphic standpoint. In other words, he looked like a human, of course, with a great, he had about an inch and a half canines, and he had a mohawk hairdo. He was solid black. Now you may have thought Doc was cute, Larry, I know you, but Doc was pretty rough looking, don't you think?
Well, you wouldn't want to run into the dark alley.
He looked like something out of a horror picture, to tell the truth.
Well, he looked like the original King Kong.
That's right. So Larry comes over. I was preset backstage, ready to go out of the curtain. Larry comes over. And I had met Doc, so I knew what to do. But I had to put my hands in front of him. Doc would sit with his back to me, looking out that way, and I would take him out. We were going to put him on Johnny's desk because Doc liked to do a war dance. Well, the problem was that he would have thrown everything that Johnny Carson had off the desk, which were some heirlooms. So we put a table out there with some chairs and all different kind of stuff on it. And I was ready to go out, and Larry comes up to me nonchalantly and says, Jim, I hate to tell you this, but Doc has reached puberty.
Uh-oh.
And now if a male stares at him, he goes berserk. And I thought, goodness, Larry, come on, what are you telling me this at the last second, you know? I can't do anything. And so I started to go out just before they called my name. Larry came back and said, yeah, he says, in fact, Doc is so bad and so aggressive now. He said, I tried to castrate him, but I didn't have time. And then they said, here's Jim Fowler.
Yep.
So, boy, I knew I was in trouble. So I go out with Doc and put him on the table. And he goes into a war dance. He sticks his hairs up like a pincushion. First thing I know, he's dancing up and down and grabbing the table, throwing chairs off. Of course, the audience is really into it, and so is Johnny. So I got the leash on Doc, and before I know it, Johnny comes up, bends over, and makes faces at Doc right in his eyes. And all of a sudden, I saw fire coming out of Doc's eyes. He comes across 6 feet through the air. I try to go to the left to stop him, but I couldn't. So he slugs Carson right in the mouth with his hand. And now Merv Griffin would have tippy-toed away, you know. Carson comes back with a karate chop, which made Doc even more furious. So he comes through the air the second time and clips Carson. But this time, I think he had his teeth open. So I think, thanks a lot, Larry. I got to get out of here, see. So I sit down, and I know good and well if I look at Doc's eyes when I'm sitting on that couch. See, I mean, it's well known that a primate, if you stare at a primate, it's like, you know, looking down your school teacher or your father sometimes, you know. So you want to keep your eyes down. You don't want to look them in the eye. So I was sitting on the couch and holding Doc right in front of me. I couldn't look at him because I didn't want to have any eye contact. So Johnny gets a grape, preset grapes, and he was supposed to feed Doc. But instead, he puts the grape over to Doc, and then he changes and puts it back in his own mouth. Oh, Lord, I could feel Doc starting to blow up like a pincushion again. So I got out of there, and then I said some things to Larry that weren't too, I can't repeat them. But he, to come up to me and say he was going to castrate Doc, but he didn't have time. I knew what that meant. So that's gone down somewhat in the history of the show.
Well, and when that was happening, I was so upset because I thought this segment's going terrible. This monkey is just nuts. And then it turns out we were watching the best of the Johnny Carson events.
Yep.
And it was like the 15th or 16th most popular segment that they'd ever had on Carson.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow. But that day, do you remember what we had with Doc?
Was it a baboon?
No, it was from the Cincinnati Zoo. We'd stay in Toluca Lake because that was the only motel that would allow animals.
Oh my God, yes.
And there was a fellow that came from the Cincinnati Zoo with his aardvark.
Mike Delaney. Yep.
And this aardvark, I don't think they ever bring this up on any on programs, but they have an odor about them. And he'd keep that aardvark in his room. And every morning when we'd get up and go to do, I think we did Regis and Merv Griffin or some other things too.
Yep.
This aroma would come out of that room with the aardvark. And I thought, boy, you must really love that animal.
You know what? I don't know if you remember. I know that one very well. Mike Delaney would put it in the bathroom of this Toluca Motel, which is right down the street from one of those marriage parlors. And there were a couple, and the aardvark in the middle of the night, claw, you know, they have claws on their front leg, just terrible claws. They can, in Africa, if you're chasing one, they can actually dig a hole faster than you can catch him almost. This is a 200-pound animal.
Right.
And talk about ugly from our standpoint. You know, it's got that sloping pig-like nose. But anyway, this aardvark tore through the drywall in the bathroom and stuck its head into the room across the way. And that was where people there had just come in on their honeymoon and were lying in bed, and they heard all this terrible clawing, and this head comes through there. Well, needless to say, they had a memorable marriage honeymoon, I'll tell you that. And Mike had to get up in the middle of the night and go in there and retrieve this aardvark, but also it had a smell that you could hardly describe. That thing was so stunk so bad you could smell it 100 feet away. If you know
it. It was
pretty hard to give an aardvark a bath. So anyway, on the show, Mike had one of these leashes that was actually a harness. See, an aardvark is so streamlined front and back, it's pretty hard to put anything on it because it just sort of slides off. So he had a harness behind his legs, and I hand Johnny the harness and I tell him to pull because I was putting sand in a sandbox so that I could show that the aardvark, when he saw sand, instinctively he would dig. That's the first, you know, it's all built in. It's a they're hardwired to do that. Well, this is also on the reruns, but he took hold of the leash and the harness, and of course the whole thing slid right off the front of this 200-pound aardvark, and he was loose. So the only way to get him to sandbox was to get behind him and push. So Johnny was on the ground, kneeling, pushing on the back of the aardvark. I was trying to pull him. We finally got him into the sandbox. Of course, you know, I could sort of at times, you know, when you're on the show, excuse me, you gotta be very aware that you have to listen to what Johnny's saying and watch what Johnny's doing so that you're the straight guy. So you can give Johnny opportunities. Well, I could also hear the audience, and on many occasions when I was on that program, I could hear the audience having belly laughs. I knew it was a successful segment if the audience were having belly laughs. So they were having belly laughs, and then also finally got the aardvark in the sandbox. And they had a tight shot on it because it was digging in the ground, right? But just in addition to digging, the minute it hit that sand, it bent down and took the biggest relief. It relieved itself like you wouldn't believe. Went all over the place, and of course Johnny had a few appropriate comments about that. But the minute it touched that sandbox, Johnny said, "Oh yeah, I see what you mean, Jim. Why didn't you tell me?" You know.
You probably didn't see this, but the prop master, the guy that built that sandbox and put the sand in, he was so mad. He blew up, boy. That was hilarious.
Well, see, the problem was the art park had been in a dog kennel for probably 3 or 4 hours, you know, coming out from Cincinnati, and hadn't been able to relieve itself. And that whole fiasco in the bedroom, in the bathroom of the motel. By the way, I haven't been invited to go back to that motel too often, but I do know them pretty well. So anyway, that aardvark saw an opportunity when it saw that sand.
Oh, it
Boy,
did.
It let loose. Yeah.
Do you remember what he fed the aardvark? That'll give you an idea. Oh. That'll give the folks an opportunity to really realize what this was like.
Yeah.
He fed it raw eggs and canned dog food.
Okay. Well, there's so many things that happened on Johnny. One of the highlights of my career, my wife Betsy and I went over and took them to Africa, took Johnny's family, his wife Alex, who's quite an adventuress, and his two sons. Neither one of the sons, I think, had been out of the United States, but took them to Africa, and boy, I tell you, it was something else.
I'll bet.
He came back and publicly said that Africa had changed his life.
I'll bet it did.
Of course, yeah. And Alex is quite a trooper. We all miss Johnny.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, there's no comparison now with the talk shows. I mean,
No, there isn't.
He was the best.
I frankly don't want to waste time on a couple of the people that are out there.
Oh, I know it is. Well, I think one of the great stories that I can remember you telling was not when Johnny was hosting, but when Alan King was hosting.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, my remember. God, yes, that's right.
You know the story I'm talking about.
I sure do. Do we have time for that?
Yeah, we have time. We got 12 minutes.
Well, I got to write all this up someday. I have written some of it, but, Alan King was in New York. He was that famous comedian. And I had been in the Amazon studying the giant harpy eagle, which is the largest eagle in the world. It eats 30-pound monkeys. And in the process, in my camp, this is one of the problems with some of the Aboriginal people. You tell them you want to film something, they think that you want them to catch it and bring it into your camp, which is sometimes they damage it pretty badly. So here, one day, they bring in a 22-foot-long anaconda that's about as big as a nail keg, and they had banged it up pretty badly with leather lassos and all like that. I had wanted them to show me where it was so I could go out and film it in the wild. So this thing was in our camp. Well, unfortunately, I had a cameraman who was so scared of snakes, he refused to even go out and film the snake if I was going to take it out of this pit I'd dug. We dug a pit, put a kind of a log fence around it so the snake couldn't get out. But it had to be in a place where the temperature was even and just leave it alone for a while. So about a month later, I was able to try to convince this guy to take it out. Well, I was telling this story to Alan King because two of the anacondas that were born in the Albany, Georgia Zoo, young ones, they were about 12 feet long. I had brought a big snake back from the Amazon and put it in this outside little zoological park. And, of course, what happened, unknown to everybody else, you know that an anaconda has delayed implantation,
right,
which means it can be bred and copulated by the male, and if the situation isn't correct, the temperature or the food supply, those eggs aren't activated for a year or so. So nobody knew the snake was pregnant. So one night there were 30 young ones went through the wire in this little cage in the zoo, and they were all over the place. The guy was picking up paper at the zoo, had a little stick with a nail in it, and he went around and he was jabbing these snakes in. But he didn't get all of them because the next day there were two or three up a telephone pole. And I was in pretty bad shape because I was luckily out of the city. But when this hit the newspapers, there were several people said they thought that Jim Fowler ought to have him put around his neck and taken back to South America. They said, we got enough poison snakes down here. And I made some, I thought was a snide remark. You know, I did it on purpose. I said, well, you know, I was sort of joking. I said, look, it'd be 30 years before one of these snakes was big enough to capsize a boat in the local Flint River. I said, don't worry about it. Well, boy, when I said that, I was in big trouble. So anyway, I ended up with two of these baby anacondas and took them to Earlham College in the naturalistic department. They were 12 to 14 feet long. They were little ones, but I took them on with Alan King in New York, and I was trying to tell Alan King that snakes are not dangerous if you know about them, et cetera, et cetera. And I showed him these two, and also I was making the point, we often dress animals up to look like human beings, and therefore we think they're cute in all these human terms, and we're not so afraid of them. Well, I demonstrated this because I noticed he was a little nervous with these snakes. I consider a 12-foot anaconda a small snake. They're nothing to worry about. So I took a red ribbon and put it around the neck of one of the snakes and gave it that little human-like feeling that looked cute. And then, you know, he would get close to that one, but he wouldn't get close to the other one. So I made my point. So then I started telling the story of the Indians bringing this big one into the camp. And by the way, when I went in to catch it, the photographer was hiding behind a tree about 100 feet away. He decided after 2 months he agreed to film it. But when I went in under this opening underground, this snake was standing 6 or 7 feet off the ground. And what you'd have to do is to take a hook stick and pull it back to you, drop the stick, and then grab the big snake by the neck. And I'm in a crouched over position, so it's sort of like rubbing your head and your stomach at the same time. So as I grabbed the snake's head with the stick, this thing struck at me, and you know, my elbow hit the door, the opening, and the first thing I knew, that 22-foot anaconda had my whole hand in its mouth.
Ooh.
And they have teeth, as you know, sloping backwards. They're like grapple hooks. And I'll speed up on this one because I want to end the story. So this thing was trying to pull me in, and I had to grab the tail. If the audience ever has this happen to them, make sure you get the tail of the snake in one hand at least, because they wrap your tail first, and if a big snake like that gets around you, you're mincemeat. I mean, they'll just crack every bone in your body.
Mm.
So meanwhile, the snake started swallowing my hand because I had the other hand holding the tail, trying to pull him out. I had three Indians that had worked with me for several months in the deep, uncharted rainforest, and I expected them to come help me. Well, I turned around and they were running off into the jungle. They never did come back. The photographer had his hand over his eyes. He wasn't even going to watch. He was so scared. He didn't even swallow. And the snake swallowed my arm up to the shoulder. Well, I was telling this story to Alan King, And I noticed he was sort of turning white and sweating a little bit, so I decided to loosen it up. This was on live television. So I said, yeah, Mr. King. There for a while, I was wondering if I would go in like this, and I stuck my arm out and held my nose, pretending like what it would be if the snake tried to swallow me. Well, he got sick right on the show. He turned green. They cut to a commercial. They didn't even want me to come back and tell the rest of the story. And he lost it. And then I saw him 10 years later at the U.S. Open. He was a tennis fan. And I walked in the clubhouse. And the first thing he said to me is, "Don't you tell me any more of that story." So anyway, what happened, the snake eventually, I got it. Brian Gumbel once backstage said to me, he had heard this story. He said, "How did I get loose?" And I told him, I said, "Well, Brian, the only way you can do it, if, you know, I knew it wasn't going to happen to him because he was frightened of snakes too. But I said, you got, and Larry probably knows this, you've got to stop struggling. If you're struggling with a big snake that weighs over 250 pounds, you better darn well stop struggling, and, or else you're triggering a instinct for him to wrap around you and squeeze you. See, a snake doesn't have anything to do all day long. They don't take their kids to the soccer match. They don't smile and say, have a good day. They're designed just to wrap something and go on for a week if necessary. So anyway, you've got to stop struggling." And then I was able to break the teeth of the snake with my left hand thumb, which didn't feel too good. And the snake backed off. So the end of the story is the snake, 2 weeks later, snake broke loose. The photographer filmed him from a long distance going through our camp. It destroyed our kitchen, went off into the tropical rainforest, and which has a forest floor mainly of leaves. So I tracked it when I came back. I was studying these big eagles. When I came back, I followed it. It went near an Indian village, and these Indians were very hostile because they said they'd lost their favorite dog. And sure enough, I saw where the confrontation had occurred, the fight had occurred. Well, see, the dog wasn't as smart as I was because the dog didn't know how far the snake could strike and came out barking at it. The snake was hungry by this time, obviously struck from a pretty long way off, grabbed the dog in the back end, and the Indians told me that they'd heard the sound of the dog for 2 days, but nobody would get near it. See, the front end of the dog was still audible, whereas the snake was wrapped around the back end. Once again, the snake didn't have anything to do. The dog kept struggling. If the dog was as smart as I was, it wouldn't have struggled. But then I saw the track of the snake, much bigger, going on down into the wet areas. And that's why they were missing their dog. And Betsy, my wife, doesn't like me to tell that story around dinner time. I've said I made a mistake a few times.
Anyway. Can't figure out why.
So I wake up in the middle of the night sometimes wondering if that dog was, you know, a foot wide and I'm maybe 2.5 feet wide, could have gotten me down. I don't think it could, Larry. What do you think?
Well, I think
22-foot anaconda.
Well, probably not. It just depends how they would have grabbed you by your face.
Well, you got to take you down. They got to take you down head first. Yeah. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
But as experienced as we both are handling these large reptiles, it's not a problem.
Okay. Well, there are lots of things to talk about, Larry. My mission is to be a spokesperson for the natural world. And you're a spokesperson for the natural world, too. But everybody can do that. We need to get out there and talk about some of the things that are important to humans, okay?
Absolutely. And Jim, I want to have an open invitation for you to come back.
Okay.
We barely scratched the surface.
Well, I'll talk to Mutual of Omaha and see if they'll let me do some more of these talks.
Fantastic. Well, it's been a real pleasure. I mean, this hour has absolutely flown by. I hope the listeners.
Maybe you can get me a copy sometime.
Well, we certainly will. We'll get you a CD of it. Absolutely.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, Larry, and we've got to get this out to the public. And you're to be congratulated for being one of those spokespeople.
Well, thank you very much, folks. This is Blog Talk Radio. Next week on the program, you might want to tune into this, Jim. Yellowstone Ranger Bob Jackson, who was very instrumental in the bison development in Yellowstone National Park, as well as the protection of the grizzly bear. He's going to be on next Thursday. Jim, thanks again. It was truly an honor. Henry, thanks for your expertise as well.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Folks, this is Blog Talk Radio. This is Larry Batson from Wild World. Have a great week. We'll see you next Thursday, same time, same place. Good night, everybody.
I went by fast.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.